Hello and welcome to Screen's Award Season podcast. I'm Matt Mueller, the editor of Screen International, and we're continuing our dive into this year's award season, looking at the shifts and shimmies along the way, assessing what's gaining momentum and what appears to be losing steam, and addressing other topics that we think will be on the minds of voters and, of course, our listeners who are just as enthralled by the awards race as we are. And when I say we, that includes my illustrious Screen colleagues joining me for today's discussion, our executive editor for reviews and new talent, Fionnuala Halligan, and our awards and box office editor, Charles Gant. Welcome, Finn and Charles. Let's kick things off by reading the tea leaves of what some of the recent US Critics Group's awards tell us. So the New York Critics Circle named Killers of the Flower Moon their best film. But they awarded Best Director to Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer over Native Son Scorsese. They also awarded Lily Gladstone Best Actress and went left field with their Best Actor choice, Franz Rogowski, for Iris Sachs's Passages. And they also gave a boost to Charles Melton in supporting for May, December, and Divine Joy Randall for The Holdovers. LA Film Critics Association, they were all in for Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest, giving it their best film, best director, and one of their gender-neutral lead performance prizes for Sandra Hüller in a joint award with her Anatomy of a Fall performance, and the other lead performance award they gave to Emma Stone for Poor Things. So just looking at those two coastal U.S. Critics awards, Charles and Phil, what are your initial thoughts on where they spread their love?
I thought it was very good news for Franz Rogowski for Passages, because I really was not expecting that nomination. And then it was quickly followed up with a nomination for him from The Independent Spirits. So that film, I have to say, although I personally loved the film and I should be leading with my heart, my head was telling me that I didn't think it was really going to figure so much in this year's award season. So I'm hoping it can now actually sneak in and engage some voter interest.
What about you, Finn?
Yes, Matt, I was thinking that these are two US-based critics bodies, and we're starting to get the UK and European awards sort of nominations in and the general sentiment. We've had our top critics picks come in for Screen at the moment, and they're going more along the lines of the LA Film Critics, which is Zone of Interest, Poor Things, Emma Stone, Andrew Scott, All of Us Strangers. So we also look at the European Film Awards as well, which went for, you know, Anatomy of a Fall, Sandra Hüller. So we're sort of seeing a bit of a similarity, I think, between UK critics and LA critics so far, but that doesn't rule anything out, but it's just interesting.
And Finn, you mentioned the European Film Awards. That was quite an interesting set of results, I thought, in the way that they really went all in for Anatomy of a Fall. So that won Best Film, Best Director, Best Actress for Sandra Hüller there. And that very much follows what happened at Cannes, where Justine Triet's film won the Palme d'Or over probably the critics' pick, I would say, which was Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest. That was the film that many people tipped to win the Palme d'Or, and it ended up not winning that, with it going to Anatomy of a Fall. I think it's interesting with Anatomy of a Fall. It really seems to be gaining momentum. The more people seem to watch it, the more sort of feedback I hear that it's people's favorite film of the year. And it's a quite interesting one with it, you know, triumphing over Zone at the European Film Awards, that where I think Zone only took a single craft award for sound. I wonder if the team on Zone is quite happy that they're now not going to be competing against Anatomy of a Fall in the international feature category, given France didn't submit it.
Yes, well, we had discussed this about France not submitting it, and it's just interesting. I said, I think, in our last podcast that it was going to be interesting to see how it managed and how it poses a question, you know, not being in that international section. It means if you want to vote for it, you have to vote big. You can't just, you know, vote for you know, and sort of think that it will win. And certainly with the European Film Awards, it was like a complete rerun of Cannes. But I have to say that, you know, Anatomy of a Fall is my film of the year, even though I love Zone of Interest. And then I'll jump in again and say, what a year. It's almost been impossible, and all the critics who've submitted their picks to me have said the same thing. It's taken us all so long. You could have Poor Things in there, Oppenheimer, you know, there's just so much this year. It really is one of the richest films, and Zone of Interest is an incredible film, and I'm really, really pleased that it's getting the recognition now out of the US, which will help move it along. I would say the only thing of zone of interest is that it could end up being in that category of international film. You know, it could be in end up being in that category that when it comes down to it, people tick that box for it. You know, Sandra Hüller's also making a case in Anatomy of a Fall as well. So which box would you tick for her, et cetera, et cetera. It's interesting, but my goodness, you know, what a year it's been.
I would chime in there and really agree with Finn that somehow Anatomy of a Fall not being submitted, it almost feels like it's rising above those films that are submitted. And I think that it could really achieve multiple nominations and just sort of be perceived and perceived differently. And I think Finn is right to say that people who will vote for perhaps the zone of interest in the international category and feel that they've done their obligation by that film. So this could really play in favour of Anatomy of a Fall, I think, not being picked by France.
Well, that's quite interesting. And in fact, both of those US critics groups picked Anatomy of a Fall as their foreign language film winner. And they also both went for Hayao Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron for the animated film win, which I also thought was interesting because that film has just opened in the US on an extraordinary $12.8 million opening weekend, which for a kind of Japanese anime film certainly breaks records, but it must give that film a massive boost for the Oscars as well and the BAFTAs.
I must admit, I did think that the Spider-Verse sequel had that award nailed on. I really thought that it was just going to cruise all the way to the winning that Oscar. So I guess The Boy and the Heron really does advertise itself as a worthy competitor. Mind you, critics are not the same as Academy voters. And there were no, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there were literally no New York or LA critics who are members of the US Academy. So I don't think we should be pay too much attention, particularly in a category like animation, where I feel that critics are perhaps not that well aligned with a typical Academy voter.
And well, in fact, then if we look at the opposite end of the spectrum, which is the Golden Globe nominations, which is where the much more mainstream films that are competing in this award season were recognized. So Barbie led the way with 9 nods. Oppenheimer had 8 nods. Killers of the Flower Moon and Poor Things received 7 each. Two women were nominated for Best Director, so Celine Song for Past Lives and Greta Gerwig for Barbie. But some interesting differences, I would say, from previous years based on the shakeup they've had of their voting membership. I mean, what are your thoughts, Charles, on how those nominations landed?
Well, there are now 300 voters in the Golden Globes compared to, I think, before the reforms, something about like 80. And it includes a lot of the people in the Fipresky group who have got slightly more perhaps sophisticated taste than the original Hollywood foreign press voters. So I was fascinated to see 3 foreign language films appeared in Best Motion Picture Drama, Past Lives, The Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall. I really don't think we would have had that situation in the past. There were 12 films nominated across drama and comedy, and only 10 of those can be at Best Picture Oscar. So it'll be interesting to see. Let's assume that they've included the 10 that are going to be nominated. My guess would be that Air, which got a music and comedy nomination, I think that Air really has a tough struggle to get that Best Picture Oscar nomination. I don't know what you guys think of the others, which are Oppenheimer, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Past Lives, Zone of Interest, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, Poor Things, American Fiction, The Holdovers, and May December. I like all those films. I guess May December has got a tougher road to climb to get that Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, there are 10 slots for the Oscars Best Picture. As you note, there's 12 films there. So for sure, it's probably too early to say where the sort of wind will blow. I mean, American Fiction, I think we mentioned, right? That seems to be the one that came out of Toronto when the Audience Award is really picking up a lot of momentum along the way. Air, I would sort of say you probably identified as the one that will face a challenge. The other one that I'm quite interested by, and only because it didn't do quite as well at the Independent Spirit Award nominations as we might have expected, was Alexander Payne's The Holdover. So that's obviously got a Globe nomination for musical or comedy. But in the Independent Spirits, it didn't make the best film or best director shortlist, whereas it was nominated in performance category and on some of the crafts category. So I think that's a bit of a knock on that, on Alexander Payne's film. I don't know if you agree with that.
Comedies winning Best Picture are few and far between, and comedies not nominated for Best Picture, the picture, they're not that many. You know, when it comes to Best Picture, the Academy tends to feel more serious about life, unless it's spectacular. So the idea that you would get American Fiction, The Holdovers, and sort of Air in there, which is light as well, would be those are the ones that will probably suffer in terms of not seeming to be of big enough stature to make it through. Also, you have Poor Things, which is a comedy, drama, thriller, whatever, but it's, you know, it's also that would mean, you know, that would make it 4 out of 10, and that won't happen. So the vulnerable ones in that category are the comedies.
I think musical and this category is actually quite strong this year. So I wouldn't be totally shocked if Barbie, Poor Things, American Fiction, and The Holdovers all kind of make it through. But there's another film that didn't get nominated, which is Andrew Haig's All of Us Strangers, which would be competing in drama. And it didn't feature very heavily in the Globes, although Andrew Scott was nominated. So it'll be interesting to see if the US Academy feels differently. I do suspect the British Academy will feel differently on that film.
The other interesting thing, looking at these Globes nominations, is I think in previous years we might have expected a film like The Color Purple to do much better than it did do. I think they got a couple of performance nominations for the film, but you know, I think in previous years, based on the membership, you might have expected that film to register much more strongly with the Globes nominations, and also possibly, to be honest, Wonka, which perhaps they just didn't see. Maybe they saw it too late in the day to sort of really latch on to. But I mean, that's one I think we will see as a much stronger BAFTA play.
I think you're right that Wonka showed too late, because I chatted to a Globes voter at the Wonka World Premiere, and that voter was about to vote in the Globes. So I really think that some of the, and obviously that voter was based in London, so I think some of the voters elsewhere might have struggled to see that film in time. I'm sure they had screenings, but you know, not everyone can make the you know, the one screening that gets offered to them.
The same with Iron Claw, isn't it? That's come on quite late.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it, but I think both of you have, right? And you both rate it quite highly.
Yeah, good performance by Zac Efron in there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, they did have a well-attended screening in London actually quite a while ago, but I suspect that perhaps not all of these voters saw The Iron Claw. One thing I will say, I think Rosamund Pike gets a real boost from these Globe nominations for Saltburn. I'm very keen on her performance. I think it's very entertaining. I think that I can't think of anyone they could have cast better for that part. That was one of my takeaways. I just thought she absolutely knocked the ball out of the park. But I wasn't necessarily expecting a nomination, and I think this really does help push Rosamund. And I'd expect to see the team behind the film now spotlighting her performance in For Your Consideration, advertising, and really, really kind of put their shoulder to the wheel for Rosamund.
I also like to see Divine Joy Randolph in there for The Holdovers. I mean, she was a treat in that film. So that's a lovely nomination in there for Best Supporting Actress.
Well, I totally concur with you on that, Finn. But I think Divine is definitely someone that in America is considered a front runner for that category. And I'd be absolutely shocked if she's not nominated for an Oscar.
And I suppose you got to say Margot Robbie got a boost as well, right? She was nominated in the Best Actress category. There's been some debate about whether she would, you know, would she make the kind of the shortlist for the Oscar category? But she certainly seems to get a boost from the Globes nomination.
Globes type nomination, isn't it? I mean, it's not a surprise, really. That's old style Globes, but yeah, I mean, great.
Old style Globes, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like Matt Damon in Air as well. It's an old style Globes nomination.
Old style Globes, yeah.
So BAFTA round one voting is now open, and that will finish on December 29th. And then we have a very short window for BAFTA round two in early January. But Charles, perhaps you could just give us a quick rundown of exactly how these two BAFTA voting windows work in terms of between juries and actual the overall voting membership.
Well, I think the disappointing thing for all BAFTA voters is that actually you don't get to vote in many categories in rounds one and round two. So a typical voter will be voting in best film. They'll be voting in their opt-in categories, which could be British film, and it could be two out of animation, documentary and film not in the English language. And then if they are a member of a craft chapter, whether they're a director or a screenwriter or a cinematographer, they'll get to vote in that group. And that will be it for round one. And it's even worse in round two, because in round two, actually, for British outstanding British film, it is a jury that will take over the top five films from the first round voting will be automatically nominated, and then a jury will pick five from the other 10. Similarly, in documentary, you have a jury that gets involved in the later stages. So it is slightly, you know, you kind of get really excited about all of these categories, and it's really only in the final round that the general voter gets to really, really fully participate. And as you rightly say, Matt, the second round of voting is an incredibly short window. It opens on the 5th of January and it closes on the 12th of January. So people really have to like take a look at those long lists, work out which categories they can participate in, which are slightly few and far between, and then really, really make sure that they see everything that's on those long lists for categories that they're going to vote in. And that's in between Jan 5 and 12.
So busy viewing time for everybody, basically. It's there's, you know, we've had the full of complete list now of films that are eligible for this year's BAFTAs. What have you both seen recently that you're particularly excited about, or that you want to flag on the podcast?
Can you go first?
Well, this is one that, you know, I have to explain the fact that I've seen a lot of the films that are submitted, and also like a lot of them quite a long time ago. So I'm not going to come to you and sort of say, my gosh, I just saw Killers of the Flower Moon or anything like that. This is me hunting around the BAFTA website and looking for things that I might not have seen. And, you know, and some films too that you sort of think, well, they're not really likely to get a nomination, but then you know, then why are they submitted? And, you know, so what is this anyway? So there was this film in Midnight Madness in Toronto called When Evil Lurks. And our critic, Nikki Bourne, gave it an amazing review, and she's quite the horror specialist. So tempted by her, she's the deputy reviews editor on Screen Daily, I dived into Damien Runa's, excuse my pronunciation, horror set against an ancient evil in rural Argentina. It's like, you know, don't move the corpse type drama. Anyway, just as a recommendation, over Christmas, any chance you can have a look at it. It's really, really good. She's right. And it's totally terrifying. So that's my gem. You know, it's not going to change the world, but if it wasn't on the BAFTA portal, I'd never have seen it. And I think we'll maybe talk about later the values of the BAFTA portal for people who are looking to raise awareness for their films. And this is one that I would say go have a look at.
I just love that as a recommendation for, you know, a film that probably very few people would likely have kind of spotlighted as one to watch unless it was in their assigned group. So yes. definitely one I've now added to my list as well.
It's also got, you know, the posters like someone with an axe. It's not the kind of film that I would normally, you know, go for, but, you know, give it a try and gird your loins.
Well, I belatedly caught up with Memory, which is the Michelle Franco film, and it stars Jessica Chastain and Peter Sarsgaard. I thought it was a very good film. And I also was thinking, you know what? I think actors are going to really like this film. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that the Screen Actors chapter of AMPAS could vote for Jessica and for Peter. And what we might see, if there's an effective campaign run, and perhaps it won't follow the playbook of Andrea Riseborough last year, after that seemed to upset a few people, I could see that actors could embrace that movie. And I wouldn't be totally shocked if either Jessica Chastain or Peter Sarsgaard earned a nomination. I thought it was a really quite quite impressive performances by both those actors, and the kind of performances that I thought actors would like as well.
It's the story, isn't it, Charles, of a woman, a troubled woman who encounters someone she thinks did her wrong. I mean, it's by Michelle Franco, and it starts off, you think that maybe he's done her wrong in the past or he's sinister, but it turns out he's suffering from early onset Alzheimer's, and she, for various reasons, comes to be with him as his carer. And it's an unexpected film, and it's pretty tough watch as well. So it's one of those ones, I agree with you, that people just sort of come to maybe a little bit later, and you know, and then it begins to gain a little bit of traction as word of mouth gets out. It was at Venice and then suffered a bit from the this SAG after a dispute, although it got an exception, and I know that Jessica Chastain was out promoting it quite heavily. So I agree with you. I'd expect those performances to be well noticed when the time comes and the word seeps through.
Well, speaking of performances, a film that I caught up recently, which just goes to show how far behind my viewing I am compared to the two of you, was How to Have Sex, which I finally watched and I thought was a fantastic debut by Molly Manning Walker. Surely a film that, you know, will feature in the British Outstanding Debut category for sure. But I wondered as well about Mia McKenna-Bruce's performance. It's so good. And I wonder if she will be either voted for, like, by, you know, or by, in a popular way, although obviously there's a lot of great performances this year and obviously much bigger names, or potentially put through by the sort of jury that decides the final list. I thought she was an amazing, amazing performance in that film.
That could happen, Matt. I mean, she would need, so first of all, in order for that to happen, a couple of things have to occur. So first of all, she would have to be in something like the kind of top, you know, 20 or something. And then the long-listing jury would have to make sure that she's on the long list. And then the nominating jury will have to make, you know, would have to like pick her from that long list. So it is quite a complex process that would happen at BAFTA, but it could happen. Often those juries are looking to, they are considering perhaps ensuring there's a more diverse balance of nominations, but that is not their specific role. Their specific role is to consider excellence, and so yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out.
She got a few hoops to jump through, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. And she does need to attract enough votes initially in order that she is in that in that sort of set of performances that the various juries are considering.
Could she go in as a rising star, Charles?
Absolutely. That is a very much a juried process. So the jury would be picking those five nominees, and they will be announced in January, and then that will go to a public vote. I would expect her to be among those five. I would be quite shocked if she's not. But I'm not on the jury, by the way. That's not me.
But you have been in the past, haven't you?
I did that jury for the first 11 years, which apparently shouldn't have happened, and which is why I've been told I can't be on the jury anymore. But yeah, I do have a certain amount of insight into that award, and just going from who's been nominated in the past, it is a very rich year for performances, because that is an international award. So you've got all kinds of people from, you know, American films, for example, that could be nominated. But I just would expect Mia McKenna-Bruce to be nominated. But we will see.
So let's talk a little bit about the final BAFTA list. I mean, we did discuss that some titles are missing that we might have expected to see on the BAFTA, you know, competing for the BAFTA Film Awards this year. They're not on the portal. It doesn't seem that they're on the sort of list of official films submitted that BAFTA has put out. Titles I think that I noticed were missing were Greatest Days, the sort of Take That musical. Charles, you mentioned how to blow up a pipeline earlier.
Yeah, and the film Reality with Sydney Sweeney, both two very strong American independent films that both actually did reasonably well at the box office. I mean, they resonated with audiences, particularly Reality.
It's not for us to say why any of those films decided not to enter, but Charles, maybe we could just talk a little bit about what the process is for entering your film, because I know there's different tiers, aren't there, in terms of pricing and for entering a film?
Well, I was actually having a conversation with a filmmaker at the weekend who made a British documentary, and they are, submitted in Outstanding British Debut, which is completely free to enter, and they've opted not to enter other categories because it costs £800 to enter, which may seem a very small amount of money, but for their film, they have a certain amount of money for their publicity and advertising, print and advertising spend, and they just felt that that wasn't a good use of £800. £800 turns out to be the discounted rate, and that rate applies to films that are British, documentaries, and for films not in the English language. And the actual full price is £8,000. So that prompted me to wonder, do all British films only pay £800? Which even if you're a big, big movie like Wonka or Napoleon, and I checked with BAFTA and they said, yes, all British films pay £800. So you've got a slightly odd situation where a big, big movie like, say, Wonka will pay £800, but a small American independent film, which is not a documentary, it's not British, and it's not in a foreign language, they would pay the full amount. Having then discovered that, what I then discovered is that there is actually an appeals procedure, and you can sort of make a case, we're a small film, we are a small distributor, the film only went out on so many cinemas, it only achieved so much box office, can we go in at the lower rate? And apparently, just talking to awards campaigners, distributors, very often that case is listened to, and you can go in at that cheaper price. I also looked at just how many films were entering across those categories, and it looks to me it's quite complicated because some films are both British and documentary, or both or documentary and foreign. But it looks like there are 236 films entering, and it looks like 160 are paying the cheaper price. And then the 76 would be the ones that don't fall into those expensive categories. And some of those will have appealed. But still, £800 is not nothing if you're a small distributor.
Yeah, and if you're obviously then looking to get further traction from voters and get your film in front of as many eyes as possible, you're looking to put on screenings. So we talked about there's the cost of hiring a screening room, which can start from, I think, £400 or £500, and then go way up to, depending on whether you go to a sort of swanky place like the Ham Yard Hotel, which comes with a kind of food and beverage cost attached as well. And Finn, do you have some insight into that?
Well, I think that the least you can get away with is between £400 or £500, but more likely £600 for something in, say, well, I won't name places, so let's not, go into it. And then after that, the sky's the limit. Are you looking at a hosted talk? Are you going to pay talent to come in? Are you going to get into grooming cars? How many of these screenings are you going to have? And then on the other side of the scale, you could just do none and put your film on the BAFTA portal. It's already, it's going out to however many thousand members of BAFTA, who might watch it. And you might consider that's 800 quid well spent, So I think, like I say, I'd never have seen When Evil Lurks if it hadn't been on there. So yeah, starting, let's just say £500 for like one screening in one Soho, venue, up to, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds, and that could just be for one event.
Echoing what Finn said about BAFTA U, I should stress that these costs were introduced when DVDs were phased out. And BAFTA View was introduced. It costs lots of money to do BAFTA View, and it's a fantastic portal, particularly if you're watching films on your Fire Stick. And distributors are saving tons of money by not having to send out DVDs. And that is the justification for the cost, which I think is completely reasonable, by the way. And I think, £800 to get your film there and to have it assigned to a viewer group so that, a chunk of voters will definitely watch your film, even if it wasn't one that may have been top of their list. I think that is a pretty good deal.
Absolutely. And it's quite an innovation, in terms of how really leveling the playing field. The viewing groups, maybe some people feel, a little bit constrained by that. But at the same time, I think it's a great way to get as many people to watch the different films on the portal as possible. And so it really has democratized the whole process for everybody. And as you say, maybe many people think this is just my opportunity to get the film in front of as many industry eyes as possible. And maybe that's their mission, rather than sort of really kind of, you know, competing to win a BAFTA.
I think that's true of all awards, Matt. I thought that certainly in the conversations I've had with British independent producers, that being in the British Independent Film Awards, you know, you're getting your film seen by hundreds and hundreds of people. And I think that would be true for the European Film Awards. I think that is one of the great, great upsides of film awards, is it really does get your film seen, and it puts you kind of on a level playing field with all of those other bigger films, just as long as people are watching. And that can be a bit of an if, but certainly being on BAFTA View is a big help.
And what about the trend in celebrity hosts for talent Q&As, which we've seen ramp up, I would say, significantly in the last couple of years? Maybe, Charles, you could talk a little bit about the changes in the rules that allowed that to happen, and how that's become quite a significant new addition to the awards landscape.
Yeah, I think they brought in that change last year that you are allowed to disclose the name of your host. And I remember talking to a documentary campaigner a couple of years ago, and they felt that this change would actually benefit, you know, smaller films where it's sometimes hard to get the attention of voters, and they would get, you know, another documentary filmmaker to host the Q&A with their own filmmaker. And they thought it would be really advantageous to be able to communicate that to voters, and it would help push them more on a level playing field with other films. I do feel that the opposite is beginning to happen, and the host inflation that is occurring when you've got the likes of Cate Blanchett or Andrew Garfield hosting these screenings. Like, the small documentary film is possibly going to struggle to get someone like that. So you may have, for example, you know, another documentary filmmaker hosting your screening, but you're still not going to compete for the attention of the voters with some of these like megastars that are hosting screenings. So I kind of worry a little bit where this is going. From last year to this year, it's been a big jump. And is it just going to be next year, you know, unless Martin Scorsese is hosting a screening, like, no one's going to pay you any attention? So I'm a little bit worried where it's going, and I kind of wonder whether BAFTA will actually perhaps start to rethink this and row back on it.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see where that goes. I agree. I mean, I think when you're looking at a film that I think the three of us all like a lot, which is All of Us Strangers, the fact that they have Andrew Garfield hosting one of their upcoming Q&As perhaps we'll get more people to go to that screening and give that film a boost. That's quite a nice boost for that film to get. It's not necessarily one that everyone will automatically watch, but it's one we all love and sort of would like to see move forward in the sort of nominations process. But yes, I think it's an interesting development, and who knows which way it will go. But I agree, Charles, there may be some, you know, there may be some sort of adjustments they need to make going forward.
I think they'll be keeping a close eye on it. Funnily, I mean, I went to see All of the Strangers again quite recently, and to a very full Curzon Mayfair main screen. They didn't have a celebrity host. They did, however, have Andrew Haig and Paul and Jamie Bell and Andrew Scott, which was, you know, enough. It was enough to generate a full house. But I guess they feel now, you know, to kind of push that boulder further up a hill, they probably, yeah, they're calling on someone like Andrew Garfield to kind of, if you weren't persuaded by the talent we offered you last week, you know, maybe this will make a difference.
Well, I'm going to a screening of Poor Things on Friday that just happens to be hosted by Cate Blanchett. I wanted to see the film. It wasn't the reason I decided to go, but of course, you know, it's exciting to have Cate Blanchett in the room presenting the film. And before we sign off, let's just give a congratulatory shout out to Trisha Tuttle for her appointment as the next artistic director of the Berlinale. She'll be taking over from Carlo Chatrian and Marietta Riesenbeek after they both stepped down after the 2024 edition. Very exciting appointment, Charles. Obviously, Trisha, someone we know fairly well, having interviewed her many times for the BFI London Film Festival, where she served for 5 years as director.
Yeah, I'm obviously very thrilled for Tricia, someone who I've known for a long time, when she used to program for the London Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, when she worked for the Script Factory and BAFTA, and then more recently when she was director of the BFI London Film Festival. And I did that interview with her for the festival for five consecutive years. And I think I'd like to think that you let me like carry on doing that, because she was always so interesting each time I interviewed her, and always really willing to answer any question, not fazed by anything. And I'm a bit of a LFF train spotter, and always like come up with some weird little difference that she'd made, and she kind of look at me going, Charles, really? But I think she'll be a fantastic appointment, and I can't wait to see what she does with the festival.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a really exciting appointment for Berlin and for Tricia, and we're very excited to see what she does when she eventually takes over there. Well, look, thanks so much, Finn and Charles, for sharing your thoughts today on where we are at the award season as it stands. Look forward to catching up with both of you in the next episode, and happy viewing over the Christmas holidays. That brings us to the end of this episode of the Screen Awards podcast. Thank you to my colleagues Finn and Charles for joining me today, and thank you very much for tuning in. Our podcast is available to subscribe to wherever you listen. Please do rate and review us along the way, and keep up with the latest news from the international screen industries at screendaily.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @screendaily. Hope you enjoyed the episode. See you next time. This episode was produced by Danielle Koch and edited by Richard Dimmery.